It's been a while since I've done a talk where I really don't have quite as good an opportunity to stand in front of the screen and gesture, but I'll do the best I can under the circumstances. My name's Rick Smith. I'm a consultant and author and lecturer, things like that. I'm out of St. Paul, Minnesota, and I'm here to talk about some of the issues with using biometrics and how they do or don't work. Also, I'm doing a book signing this evening, my book, Authentication from Passwords to Public Keys, which came out last fall. So what we'll be talking about here is first just basically what biometrics are about, why people care about them, how strong, how they operate, also, and then talk about server-based biometrics, which is sort of a traditional approach that a lot of people have talked about with them, and then ways of attacking the biometrics, particularly in a server situation. Those, not all biometrics are used specifically in, say, a central server with multiple readers, but there are certain types of attacks that seem to be peculiarly effective in that circumstance. Then token-based biometrics, which is something I've always thought held a lot of promise, except for some issues with just biometrics by themselves. Then finally, physical spoofing. There's been some really terrific stuff going on recently on that, and we'll look at some of those. And both voluntary and involuntary spoofing. Involuntary spoofing being when the victim doesn't know that their biometric materials have been compromised and are being reused. Okay, so why do we want biometrics? Well, the first thing is eliminating memorization. People have a terrible time with passwords, in case you didn't know. Is there anybody here who has less than 6 passwords? I didn't think so. Oh, well, just wait. Just wait. Okay, so that's the thing. You don't have to memorize these things. They're built into you. You've got your eyeball. You've got your fingerprints, et cetera, et cetera. Misplaced tokens. Has anybody here not lost their car keys ever? Didn't think so. Well, just wait. Again, you know, it's interesting the amount of human engineering that people do on a personal basis so they don't lose things or forget things. And a lot of times those personal habits turn into security issues. That's not a topic we're going to cover here, but it is an important thing to keep in mind when looking at the general issues of authentication. Okay, then the other nice thing about biometrics is, at least in theory, they shouldn't be, you can't delegate them. I can't give some, if you need my fingerprint to get access to a certain thing, I can't lend it to you. Whereas if you have a token, usually there's some way it can be lent. Passwords are, you know, idiotically easy to delegate, and that's their fundamental problem. Not only don't you know that they've been delegated, but there's no way to limit how much they've been delegated. Also, the nice thing is biometrics are often unique, and this provides the opportunity to use them in a variety of applications that regular authentication techniques just don't work for. Notably, trying to save money on eliminating duplicate enrollments in situations where multiple or duplicate enrollments are a problem. Okay, so what's the dilemma? The dilemma is they always look stronger and easier to use than they really are in practice. Enrollment turns out to be really difficult. I'm not going to talk about that a lot other than to mention it here and a little bit later. But the thing is, easy enrollment means unreliable authentication. The two really trade off. Also, measures to prevent digital spoofing make even more work for administrators. So essentially, you can either have a little bit riskier system with a higher risk of spoofing and masquerade, or you can have a more secure system that's a lot harder to use. And then finally, physical spoofing is a lot easier than we'd like, and I'll give you several examples of that. Okay, so how do biometrics work? Usually they come into two categories. You've either got measuring a physical trait, or measuring user behavior, which, again, is something associated with a particular individual. So, for example, the classic physical trait is, of course, the fingerprint. It's wonderful thing of lore and legend and, mystery stories and everything else. We've all learned about fingerprints over the years, and computer-based fingerprint systems have really come into their own in the past few years as far as being not too expensive. So that's been really nice. There are also hand-eye face recognition systems. Face recognition has, of course, gotten a lot of press recently with demonstration systems going on in airports. Okay, user behavior, voice. If you have a copy of one of the older or one of the not quite as recent Apple operating systems, they have voice recognition built in. We used it in our family for, well, I don't know, I think one of my kids sort of clung to it valiantly for about 6 months before deciding it was just way too much of a hassle to use. Written signature, some people have tried using that, and also keystroke dynamics. So those are some of the techniques that get used. Okay, one of the questions, though, is, okay, given that you have all these techniques, well, how strong are they? Well, in order to answer that question, you have to look at three basic types of attacks. There's the trial and error attack, which is the classic thing people think about. If you have a room full of people with all these individual fingerprints and they all take turns trying to log in as John Doe, what are the chances? How big does the room need to be? How many fingers do you need before there's a good chance, say a 50-50 chance, that somebody's going to strike it rich and their particular fingerprint is going to look close enough to Joe Blow's or John Doe's or somebody else's? That's a classic way of measuring strength. Another issue of attacking is digital spoofing, the notion that ultimately in these computer-based systems, we're sending around these digital patterns. So why don't we just take a digital pattern and replay it, essentially treat the binary representation of the fingerprint reading as the guy's password, and just replay it the same we would if we intercepted somebody's password. And then finally, there's the issue of physical spoofing, where you actually try to manufacture some appliance or prosthetic, as it were, that simulates an individual's biometric attribute so that you can then present that attribute to one of the sensors and trick the sensor that way. There are lots of examples of that, and we'll be talking about that a lot later. Okay, so the way I like to think about trial and error attacks on any authentication system is in terms of how many trials it takes to achieve a 50-50 chance of success. That gives you this really great opportunity to compare, well, apples with oranges. At least they're both types of fruit, as opposed to, say, apples and, I don't know, Volkswagens or something. But at least it gives you at least a starting point for doing some comparisons. A typical objective in authentication systems, which personally I think is completely unrealistic, but it's in a bunch of standards, is 1 in a million. In other words, the chances, if somebody walks up, the chances are 1 in a million that, they'll be able to trick the authentication system into authenticating them. Now, some systems achieve this in some sense, but most actually aren't that accurate in practical settings. If you have a password system that claims to achieve 1 in a million, there are a lot of ways that you can, if you look at it closely as a global system, you can find a lot of situations within it and properties of it that push the probabilities way, way lower than that, down to maybe 1 in 2. Okay, and then there's the notion of team-based attack in biometrics, and that's this notion if you have a room full of people doing things. Normally in other types of authentication mechanisms, if you're attacking them, you don't actually need a bunch of different people. I mean, it might help, but in biometrics, you either need a bunch of different people or you need prosthetics of some sort. Okay, so let's look at password average trial and error just as a baseline for comparing strength of an authentication system. If we just look at your canonical trial and error on a random 8-character Unix password, you can get about 2 to the 45th if you have to try to go through all of those 96 characters and 8 characters long and all that sort of thing. On the other hand, if you look at a dictionary attack and the chances that somebody has chosen a password from a dictionary, then the odds drop dramatically, and now the number of trials is around 2 to the 15th to 2 to the 23rd. If you take it one step further and say, well, okay, we're also going to visit their workplace and look around their workstation area to see if they have written their passwords down, the odds fall even more. My own experience in looking at passwords hidden in people's work areas, say the chances are, I'd say in good situations, maybe 4% of the time somebody hides a password. In bad situations, it's about 38% of the time. So it's pretty nasty. So we can do better than that with biometrics. Isn't that nice? Okay, so biometric authentication. Okay, here's just the mechanism involved. It's very similar to classic passwords, in fact, except that what's happening is you have this feature extraction process instead of just collecting the characters from the keyboard, and then you have this notion of pattern matching instead of a simple binary match. And so you still have this notion of sort of that thing that you're comparing against, which we'll call a biometric signature here, the thing that got read out of the sensor, but then you're comparing it against a pattern, which is more of an aggregate of multiple signatures to sort of average them out and get something that is more likely to match in most cases. Okay, here's an example of a really trivial biometric, just to sort of capture some of the basic ideas for those of you who haven't really thought about biometrics much. Let's say we're going to base a biometric on the length of your fingers. It's entirely possible to do this. It's not clear that this is going to have a good enough rate of acceptance and rejection so that you could actually use it in practice, although there are hand geometry systems that use a lot more information that are actually quite good. But anyway, in this case, all we're doing is we're measuring the length of those 5 fingers in this user named Kathy and comparing it against a biometric pattern that we have already collected from her. And we're also comparing it against one belonging to a fellow named Tim. So in the ideal circumstance, the distance, mathematical distance between Kathy's pattern and Kathy's biometric signature that we just read should be relatively small, whereas the distance between hers and Tim's should be large. That's what we want to have happen. Now, over time, let's say we run this system with hundreds or thousands of measurements, we'll get a couple of curves here. In one case, we get Kathy measuring different readings from her palm against the distance of those readings from her own pattern. And notice what we want is most of the time those numbers should be fairly high. That's that leftmost graph there. And so what we want is most of the time we should have a very small number for that distance, which means it's a really good match. The right-hand graph is, let's say we compare readings from other people against her pattern. There, we should very rarely have a close match. Most of the time we should have a distant match. So the distance should be larger in most cases. That's what we want to have happen. So the way it works out is, if you throw the two together, you essentially end up with this dashed line, which says on one side, this is where we're going to accept the pattern as matching, and the other line, we're going to say, no, the pattern doesn't match. Now, sometimes you're going to make mistakes there, and this gets into these notions of false acceptance rate versus false rejection rate, which are, yay. Correct.
If you want to say false positives cost me more than false negatives, then move.
True, but no matter how you do it, you still have the problem. No matter how you do that. And so that's essentially what we're getting at here. So essentially the point here is you do have those two issues, the false acceptance rate and the false rejection rate. Traditionally, people try to measure these systems at the point where the two are equal, the rates are equal, and then talk about that rate. Now, in practice, you may want to do things a little differently. The problem is, of course, the lower we make the false acceptance rate, the fewer successful attacks we have, but then the less tolerant we are of close matches by attackers. Also, the less tolerant we are of authentic matches. So we increase the false rejection rate. So the lower false acceptance rate means it's less often that we will let somebody in incorrectly, less often we'll allow a masquerade, but it also increases the likelihood that we will reject people. So we won't we end up doing different types of mistakes. The lower false rejection rate, if we lower the false rejection rate, it's easier to use. We recognize legitimate users the first time. But on the other hand, there's a good chance it will also allow masquerades because we're a lot more tolerant of mistakes, of uncertainties. Okay, so what does this come down to? Okay, if we're looking to minimize the average attack space, if we're looking for that one in a million, then, yeah, you can do that. But then there's the question of what does that do to your false rejection rate? I know when I have used thumbprint readers, you can turn them up real high, but that means that, you're putting your thumb down a lot, you're wiping the thing off, doing things like that to make it more accurate or make it more reliable. And also there is a percentage of the population that simply does not have fingerprints that are sufficiently well-defined to work with the versions of the readers that we use today. So that's just sort of a fingerprint issue, but it actually applies to most biometrics. When my family was using that voice recognition system, the real problem was that there was no way of tuning false acceptance and false rejection very well for that particular system. Yeah, exactly. I'll be getting to that. Yes. Yeah. Oh, okay. I'm not sure what the gist of it was, other than that it is material that I'll be covering. I'm sorry. It was just an issue of making this, addressing the more practical issues. How do you actually make this all work? Okay. Now, before I get to that, though, let me talk briefly about biometric enrollment and where some of the other issues can, some of the other problems can come in. Essentially, how it works is, the user has to provide one or more biometric readings. If we say this as technologists, that's obvious. Yeah, you just collect a bunch of biometric readings. On the other hand, if you say it from the point of view of usability of the system, what this means is somebody has to sit there and go through this. They have to know how to do it correctly, and they have to do it for long enough so that you can get something that is going to provide effective authentication. With systems like passwords and tokens, there are ways to pre-enroll, whereas with biometrics, you actually have to have the person interacting with the system in order to set things up so that you can authenticate them later. And ideally, you'd like them to go through this process several times, give them several readings of the same fingerprint or have the person repeat the same phrase over and over again if you're authenticating using a phrase, because then you have a better chance of building a good pattern. Okay, if we compare this with token enrollment or password enrollment, the big difference has to do with self-enrollment. You can actually do a lot of the pre-enrollment work with tokens and passwords. Now, these systems are hackable in a number of ways in that they tend to be based on personal information that may or may not be available to a third party. Usually these systems rely on the fact that there's just this small time window in which they're expecting the enrollment to occur in order to reduce the risk of somebody attacking the system and stealing somebody else's pre-enrollment. But on the other hand, then the other person may detect it. But the point being that there are ways to do it with the older systems, even if there aren't good ways to do it with biometrics. Also, there's the biometric privacy issue. Okay, biometric patterns act like passwords, but they're not secrets. Essentially, you leave artifacts of your voice, your fingerprints, all of your biometric properties all over the place. I mean, and so there are all these opportunities for a third party to pick them up somehow. Exactly, yes. The observation there was the more systems that use biometrics, the more often these biometrics are also going to find their way into databases and such. And the whole concern there is now it becomes possible to trace people's activities by following their biometric readings. And no amount of anonymity processing is going to prevent the fact that a particular fingerprint is in this database. If it got there because a particular person was doing something, you can tie that person to that access. Well, more or less. We'll talk about that a little bit too. And of course the fundamental problem, which another person brought up a moment ago, was that you can't change your biometric if it is compromised in a bad way. So if you're trying to remain private and your biometric has been compromised, you're in trouble. If there are systems out there that are using your biometric to authenticate you and they're not very well designed systems and there's a possibility of sort of slipping a spoofed reading into the system, then you're really stuck because you don't have another fingerprint. It's the only one you've got. It's probably easier to change your fingerprint than your social security number, which is odd but probably true. Okay, server-based biometrics. I don't know. I think server-based biometrics are kind of boring in that I ended up using the same diagram a second time. Maybe that's why I thought it was boring. But essentially, there are certain applications that require servers, like, for instance, the automated fingerprint identification system, things like that, where you get these, advantages of scale by having everything in a single database. Also, uniqueness systems like those used in social service organizations and communities, that's been a big application, and it's one of those things where the vendors can show a return on investment to installing the system. So a lot of communities look at that as a way of reducing what's perceived as welfare fraud. Of course, this also has this other issue in that in some communities have actively resisted this because of a concern that the fingerprint information would also be used in forensic law enforcement applications. So not everybody wants to see those systems go in. Also, there's this... What's that?
How likely is it that something of quality would be used to biometric if you rely on the new biometric?
Well, that's an interesting... The question is, what's the likelihood that the biometric being used in an application like this is good enough for law enforcement? And the thing is, what you're using the biometric for in the law enforcement application is to look for a set of likely candidates. Once you have that information, there's usually a lot of ways by which you can then extend it further. Clearly, the biometric by itself and the fact that the readings match are not sufficient, at least in this country, probably to convict anybody of anything. But they could provide the leads necessary in order to do that, to, you know, take it to the next step. So I think that's probably the area of concern. And then also there's the whole thing of systems with shared biometric readers, which is in a sense the model that a lot of biometrics vendors go by, in that you should have these readers, they're plugged into, say, a bunch of your machines, but the readers themselves simply collect the biometric and then feed it to a centralized database of biometric readings and then do the authentication from there. And that is the essential point here. And as you can see in the diagram, there's a list of users and there's, you know, biometric patterns for the individual. So it's all aggregated in one place. And that whole aggregation issue is another whole problem. I know I talked to a community a couple of years ago who was looking into this whole issue of biometrics being applied to social services. And they were dealing with the fact that, well, on one side you had the community, members of the community who were concerned about law enforcement using this information, and then you had the vendor who was concerned with providing confidence that this was unlikely to occur. And then there were some other people involved who were saying, there's a technological solution for this, which is that you just build the technology so there's no way that it can be abused. And my conclusion was there's no way to do that. If the system can match a fingerprint, it can match a fingerprint. It doesn't know whether the fingerprint comes from a law enforcement person trying to match a latent print or from an individual who is physically there actually putting down their finger. There's no real practical way of preventing that database of fingerprints from being used for forensic purposes, other than procedural things in which you get this a bunch of legislation and agreements within a community coalition to say, yes, this is the way we want it to happen. And not everybody trusts those sorts of arrangements, since, of course, legislation can change. What's that? Right. Yeah, the observation was that what's going to happen if, say, all the local grocery stores need your fingerprint in order to authenticate you for your credit or cashing a check or whatever they do, plus the local casino needs your fingerprint in order to authenticate you, plus you're using it at work to access highly sensitive information. I guess you had said classified information, but it all comes down to the point that if your biometric is being used as an authenticator by itself, then all of a sudden it does become very sensitive. I think as a practical matter, simply using it by itself, it just doesn't work because there are too many ways it can be intercepted. Okay, this diagram here actually is not a biometric example. It's a password sniffing example, and the whole point is the two are essentially the same problem. If you're logging in with a user ID and a password, you're logging in with a user ID or just a plain old fingerprint, it doesn't matter. Somebody can still sniff it and replay it. Okay, so how do we deal with server attacks on this server traffic? One is the issue of the privacy. How do we protect privacy? And the defense is, of course, encrypting it while it traverses the network. Duh. Yeah, figures. I don't know what to do. I will defer to anybody else. That's really unfortunate because the diagrams in the book, they're okay, but I have some really terrific pictures that I was able to stick in to this presentation. Can I go ahead and keep clicking? Okay, essentially, though, what I'm getting to is, in one direction. Sorry about that. It's going completely without hardware here. Need hardware support at one point or another. Okay, well, as I was saying, okay, in one situation, you have the privacy of the biometric information. I mean, in a sense, that's a fig leaf because you're going to leave it on glasses at work. You're going to leave it on environmental surfaces all over the place. You'll talk to people in the street, and your voice then is captured. Oh, well, we're sort of back. Well, we can zip through here. Here, let me do it. Okay, and then the other case is spoofing the digital biometric reading. In other words, one of the ways of looking at the problem is it's an issue of authenticity. If we can prove that we captured the biometric from a reader that we trust, then we should be able to assume that that is the reading from the individual. So from that point, we're not so concerned about the privacy, at least as far as the authentication problem goes. As long as we have high confidence that a person absolutely had to put their fingerprint on a reader, or they absolutely had to talk to a speaker or something, or had to be in front of the camera, then we authenticate the camera, or we authenticate the thumbprint reader, and then essentially infer the authenticity of that biometric signature from that point. So that's an approach. Now, the thing is, we can do this with trusted biometric readers. And essentially, the security objective of a device like that would be reliable data collection. But it means you have to embed a cryptographic secret into every trusted reader. This increases the development cost of the reader, and it increases the administrative cost of the biometric system. All of a sudden, it's not just that you have to get all the users to sit down and train themselves with the biometric readers. You also have to make sure those readers have been populated with keys. I was listening in on the wireless stuff this morning. And one of the big issues they're running into with WEP is that you need secret keys on all your endpoints. And, of course, you know, the most traditional ancient way of doing key management is crypto nets, where everybody gets the same key. You know? And once you do that, then you really don't have as much control over who and what is really authentic, because it becomes too easy for people to intercept those keys or extract them somehow. And so essentially the problem with the trusted biometric reader is not that there's anything wrong with it, it's just it's more expensive to administer. You have to enroll the users and you have to enroll the readers. Okay, another problem with servers is this whole notion of being able to say, attack capacitive fingerprint sensors. And this is fingerprint specific, but the thing is, what you want to be able to do with fingerprints is be able to know that each time the person puts their fingerprint down, you get a new reading. So if you get the same reading twice, you ought to be able to discard it. Well, if you have readings coming in from a bunch of different readers all over the place, then you can't really save the last two. Well, how many are you going to save? The last two, the last 10, the last 100, in order to know whether or not you've had a replay. And so I'm looking at these particular attacks as being server attacks simply because they are, in a sense, a replay. And that makes it, and they're a bit harder to deal with in a server-based environment. There are actually two general examples. One was back in 1998, Willis and Lee in Network Computing Labs looked at six fingerprint readers and figured out which ones they could spoof and things like that. More recently, I took German in high school. I have no idea how C'T would be spoken in English or in German, but that's the name of the magazine. It's a German magazine. It has a terrific article, which has been translated into English, which describes a number of techniques these people used in order to try to trick biometric readers. Now, the capacitive fingerprint sensors work by essentially looking for material with skin-like response within the matrix of a sensor. So you'll have a 65 kb sensor, and it will collect maybe 20 minutiae off of the fingers. Now, minutiae are those little spots on the fingerprint where there's something interesting, like a split or a Y or some other interesting feature which is, you know, distinct from simply just having some ridges curving around. And so the sensors will collect those minutiae and then do pattern matching according to where they are located on the finger. Now, traditional identification techniques use 10-12 minutiae. 20 minutiae is simply what they've been able to find works. Now, these attacks exploit the fatty oils left over from the last user logon. Here's the first one. Yes, that's a bag of water being held on top of the sensor. Essentially, it's a thin-walled plastic bag of warm water. What it does is it gives enough contrast to the oil ridges that are left the last time the person used the reader so that it fools the reader. Now, in theory, this shouldn't trick the system, but in fact it does. And if you have a sufficiently distributed system, there are often ways that you can still use this, even if they try to detect replays of previous patterns. Oh, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. This is just the tip of the iceberg. Exactly. A lot of systems don't. And that's one of the problems. The thing that's interesting about this is that it's moderately effective even when the system is set for very high sensitivity. Here are a couple others. A really easy one is simply breathing on the fingerprint reader. Yeah, you're not looking for a pulse. Not all, but that's the point, is that when you're looking at products like this, a lot of times cost is a major driver, and not all of them are looking for all that other information. And also, ultimately, that stuff gets encoded in a binary pattern that gets sent, and there are ways to trick that as well. Now, the breathing doesn't work as often, but it doesn't require a plastic bag. Okay. The hard way is, of course, to go detective style, get some of that graphite powder that that catches the oil from the fingerprint ridges, and then take a piece of sticky tape and put it over it. And let's see, the CT people had almost 100% success rate with that. Willis and Lee used it, and they were somewhat less successful. I think about half, 3 out of 6 readers they were able to make it work with. Okay, now, I was getting to this notion about replaying the same pattern. According to Siemens, who made the ID mouse that showed up in the CT examples, the authentication procedure is supposed to remember the last fingerprint reading used. It's supposed to remember that last signature. So if the same signature comes in again, it shouldn't be authenticated. Of course, on the other hand, if you have a distributed system with multiple readers, the guy logs in here today, there tomorrow, and then somebody then plays one of these games on the original reader, you still got the same problem. You either have to keep a long history or you just give up in disgust. What's that? Yeah, you could keep a database, you know, as well as keeping an encryption key for each of your trusted readers. You could also keep a record of the last fingerprint received from each reader, which, you know, that's doable, but you just keep adding to the complexity. Yes, sir? You might want to explain that your thought process on that a little bit further. He's saying that the longer you keep that history, the more likely you're going to have errors in the system. Oh, okay. What you're saying, okay, you're assuming that they're actually doing some processing on the ones that have been saved other than doing sort of a rather simple comparison. Okay, he's saying that if you've collected six readings and you've rejected all six and then you collect a seventh, even if maybe they're all legitimate, isn't it likely that that seventh will also be rejected? And I'm not sure that's true. I think it depends on I wouldn't assume that unless it was built into the system, and it's not clear to me that this type of approach where they're just trying to reject obvious replays would necessarily do the type of processing you suggest. Oh, okay. What he's saying is that if you do an analysis over a large number of collected patterns, then at some point you're going to have something that looks pretty much like a close match. And yeah, that's a good point. In other words, the more you're collecting, the more likely the matches are going to be closer. Okay, observations on the whole thing. I think we've already covered some of this. Okay. Siemens put this defense in where they're supposed to reject a match that's too close, but it didn't work in practice. The tape also, if you're doing the tape approach, you could probably reposition it or maybe even move it to a different reader to maybe fool that a little bit. And also the whole thing of multiple biometric readers, which we've already talked about. Okay, question. Here's another issue. Active biometric authentication. To some extent, this addresses the issue of looking for a pulse, but also in a sense, it brings up a more general question, which is, can't we build biometric readers that look for live properties so that we don't need all this extra trusted biometric reader stuff? Can't we just have the readers collect enough information from the person in real time so that you can say, well, you have to have had a human being there to generate that particular data stream? Examples include requiring non-static input that matches the built-in pattern, digital attack, in that if somebody is able to manufacture something that looks like your personal biometric pattern, then you can build an engine that will generate plausible digital biometric signatures for that pattern. So in a sense, you can do the whole thing without having the reader. Also, there's an ease of use issue in that you then have to train the users a bit more of how to use the system. The notion of having a biometric reader that looks for a pulse is actually a very nice idea, just from the point of view that you have your pulse, you don't turn it on and off, it's just there. On the other hand, a dynamic digital attack would very easily, get around that. Okay. Yeah, okay, I basically talked about that while I was talking about the last slide. The idea here is essentially you can attack an active biometric by building a pattern for a person. And as we talked about earlier, biometrics really aren't secrets. They're properties of your body that you slough off as you move through life. You leave fingerprints everywhere. You're talking all the time. Think about our lunchtime speaker. If you could use his voice to get in the front door at NSA, well, gee whiz, you have this, we probably have recordings of it all over the place now, and we can just, build our little biometric pattern and then use it to generate the appropriate words and the appropriate intonations to get in the front door. Of course, NSA doesn't work that way. They actually have human being guards there, too, which makes it a little more difficult. not impossible, just different. Okay, so anyway, you build the plausible. During login, the attacker is prompted for something like a spoken phrase, and the attack software generates the digital message appropriate to answer whatever that challenge is. The thing is, if you look at it purely from a mathematical standpoint, you can always do that. Did I miss something? Okay, the question, okay, that's an interesting observation. What is proposed here is that we generate very large database of biometric properties of individuals we wish to authenticate, and then we use those properties in order to provide a level of biometric authentication or confidence in our biometric authentication that an attacker can't keep up with simply because there's so much information in there. That's an interesting thought. One of the challenges there is dealing with the fact that people do change over time. I know that handprint readers, they've actually come up with some techniques by which the pattern adapts as the person gets older, and they have examples of some apartment buildings where they had children who were enrolled in the system, and as they grew older, the patterns adapted as the hands changed. I don't know how effective those systems actually were in practice as far as, you know, being able to reject people or be able to reject imposters. And that's kind of where the whole issue comes in. As the body changes, do we know enough to build that type of biometric that will both track the changes accurately and not get messed up with either false acceptance or false rejections? Did this die again? Oh, yes, Microsoft and ease of use. Well, let's see. Okay, what was I going to talk about next? Okay, next I was going to talk about biometric tokens. I think what I will do is see if I can kill this and start it up again. Biometric tokens, I think, are one of those really neat ideas where instead of having the biometric, oh, that didn't work. Instead of having a biometric database, you have the biometrics all hidden away in this token that you carry around. Let me see if that works. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. My wife just got this laptop, and I thought I'd try using it because it's really light, but that's where we were. Okay, so the whole point is, okay, I like the idea of authentication tokens because this notion of having to memorize a lot of passwords I think is just nonsense, and any of the passwords that we can memorize are probably a little bit too easy for somebody else to extract if they really want to. So the notion of tokens is really nice. The notion of a biometric token seems especially nice because you don't have to memorize a PIN. Although in practice, we're probably getting as much safety from a memorized PIN as we are from these biometrics. This particular example is, well, I think they call it the puppy, and that's a fingerprint reader underneath that little doorway there. Okay, but anyway, here's the whole point of token technology is you're resisting copying and other attacks because you're storing an authentication secret in a tamper-proof package, or at least tamper-resistant. So essentially you either look at the token in order to get authentication data out the front in the old-fashioned tokens, or the more modern types like smart cards or PC cards or even those, you know, those great little USB keys. You plug it into the side of your computer, and it has all the authentication credentials in there already. And in theory, they're hard to extract. That's a really nice technique. And here's the whole point about, you know, trial and error attacks. If you start looking at the types of trial, at how well the different approaches resist trial and error attacks, you can really pump those tokens up pretty high. Now, this all assumes that the attacker hasn't managed to steal the token. But then that's another part of the whole puzzle, is that if you need a token in order to authenticate, then if that gets stolen, you know it. And that gives you a little extra piece of protection. So I like tokens. Okay, what's the operation? The real authentication is based on that built-in secret. It's not built on the biometric anymore. Biometric is simply a glorified PIN. So the user retains control over their biometric pattern. That's a big advantage of this. A lot of the privacy issues go away. Also, the biometric signatures don't have to traverse networks, so you don't have this sniffing issue or other privacy issues associated with that. Problems are, well, the biometric tokens cost more, and cost is always a big driver in systems like this. Why does everybody use passwords? Because they come for free, quote unquote. Never mind cost of, you know, never mind total cost of ownership and help desk and the whole social engineering world. As far as people are concerned, passwords are free because they come with the software. Also, one of the problems with using biometrics in a token is that there's not a lot of room to put in a really good biometric reader that'll look for liveness properties. Now, one of the nice things is when you do put the reader in there, there's really no spoofing path other than doing physical spoofing, which we'll talk about in a moment. Okay, attacking the biometric token. If you can trick the reader, you can probably trick the token. Digital spoofing shouldn't work, as I was just saying. We've eliminated that data path. There's no way to produce a digital biometric pattern and slide it into the system in order to unlock the token. On the other hand, we have that issue of latent print reactivation. You know, the bag of water or breathing or whatever. That problem's still there. The tokens should be able to detect replays of that sort, though, at least to some extent. On the other hand, there's the issue of attacks by cloning the biometric artifact. And that gets to our voluntary and involuntary cloning, which I'll talk about now. Okay, voluntary finger cloning, fingerprints, it's a very easy thing. Five steps. Step one, select the casting material. Soft and free molding plastic was used by Matsumoto, who did this wonderful presentation, which I think was picked up by news services a few months back. I have some of his pictures I managed to throw in here. And essentially, he used the special molding plastic. You could also use a large soft wax candles. The CT people did that. And the fellows at Network Computing did something like this, too. I forget what they used for casting material. It was probably more likely something like candle wax. You push the finger into the soft material, of course, let it harden. Pour a layer of gelatin into the mold, let the gelatin harden, and you're done. Matsumoto managed to do this in about 40 minutes per finger. Okay, here's his technique. Yes, police do collect fingerprints as evidence, yes. That's an interesting, he's asking whether or not, he pointed out that police use fingerprints in order to identify people at crime scenes, and doesn't this mean that the days of doing that are over? Let's reserve that question for a little later, but I think that's a good point to bring up. Okay, so this step here is simply, you know, pressing a live finger into some softened plastic to build a very nice mold, a few dollars worth of materials, 10 minutes. And then he called these gummy fingers because you essentially use gummy bear sort of material. in order to produce this, and you just pour this liquid gum into the mold, let it harden, and then you have this little thing that almost looks like a fingertip. And the really creepy part is you can almost put it over your finger and use it, and a third party observing you do this might not even tell that you're using this gummy finger over your real finger. Now, what's the effectiveness of this? Okay, in 1998, when Willis and Lee tried this stuff, they tricked 4 out of 6 fingerprint sensors they tested. Falheim, those are the people at CCT, they tricked both optical and capacitive sensors with clone fingers. Optical sensors are literally scanners that just, you know, look for the ridges using light as opposed to using capacitance in order to measure. So it's subtly different as to exactly how they respond to different fake fingers. But in fact, they were able to trick both with this. And Matsumoto tested 11 different sensors and was able to trick all of them. Okay, now the question of involuntary cloning. The previous example I showed, and in a sense this gets back to the notion, the question of crime scenes and such, the previous example actually involved people participating and colluding in order to make fake fingers, because you had to get the guy to put his finger into that material in order to make the fake. Well, what about cloning biometric features without somebody's participation? Oh, Hollywood, you know? Never Say Never Again, 1983, they cloned a retina, for heaven's sakes. You know, it's science, you know, it's more science fiction than anything else. I mean, that was really gross, but I wouldn't want to, I don't know what they could possibly offer to me to make me want to do that. Especially since the beautiful girl killed the guy once they were done with him. Okay, sneakers, 1992. The guy walks up to the front door of his, you know, super secret place and says, "My voice is my password." So the girl takes him out on a date and tape records all of his stuff so they can get all the words in. And then Charlie's Angels went through similar sorts of thing. They had an eye scan from a laser and fingerprints from beer bottles, et cetera, et cetera. Well, it turns out that some of this stuff actually works. Heaven help us. The cloned face. Okay, this is from CT in Germany. They actually took somebody's picture, put it on a laptop image, and then held it in front of the authentication camera, and they got it to work. Now, I know one afternoon when I really had nothing better to do, I tried doing a similar thing with the Macintosh voice authentication. The problem was that the Mac wouldn't recognize me even when I said it myself, so that, you know, replaying it didn't really matter. Okay, so anyway, here, literally, you see it, you know, the picture shows it all. And one of the interesting things is they do have liveness that they build into some of these, and the CT people played with that too, in that for the face recognition, they actually look for the person to move their head a little bit in order to make sure that it's real. Well, they took a video, and they ran the video on their laptop, and that worked too. And evidently, there are some reports, I haven't actually seen these reports myself other than anecdotally, you know, like, say, a mention in passing and risks or something like that of, oh yeah, somebody tried that with an iris scanner and made it work. I don't have evidence of that, but there is a rumor. Okay, Matsumoto's second technique. He originally had those really great techniques for, you know, making those copies. This is for doing it from a latent print. Latent print being the term for just a fingerprint left on an environmental surface. First, you capture that clean, complete fingerprint on a glass, a CD, or other smooth, clean surface. If you think back several slides to that Sony Puppy biometric token, you know, it's got a nice smooth surface on it. You know, you grab it real hard when you pull it out of your pocket. You probably leave some really great fingerprints on that token. So probably you could get some from there. And then you pick that up using tape and graphite, a nice, police procedure thing that if you haven't learned it by watching police stuff on television, you can find a book about it. Then you scan it into a computer at high resolution and do digital enhancement of the image. People can do that. It's not that big of a deal. And here's the good part. What you do is you take printed circuit board material and etch the image onto that. Rubber stamp material. Okay, it's also a recommendation here. Okay, and then you use that as the mold to make the gummy finger. And here's the example here. The middle picture there shows putting the gum onto the PCB material, and then at the rightmost picture, both sides, shows gently peeling off the gummy finger with the latent print on it. Now, this gives us a real dilemma here, because tokens tend to be smooth objects of metal or plastic, which will hold latent prints well. So if you're trying to authenticate using if you're trying to use a biometric as a substitute for a PIN in a token, well, how do you prevent the token from picking up those fingerprints? Another issue. So you have this issue, an attacker steals the token, lifts the latent prints from it, and constructs a working clone of the owner's fingerprint. At least it's possible in theory. Worse, can the attacker reactivate the latent fingerprint that's sitting on top of the reader? One observer looking at the Sony Puppy noticed that cover on it should be able to wipe the previous latent print off, but doesn't necessarily do it. So it would be nice. You know, you could actually design these devices in various ways in order to reduce the risk of these sorts of problems. Say that again? Little windshield wipers, yes. Yes. Sounds like something. No, never mind. Okay, summary. FAR and FRR statistics don't tell the whole story about biometric vulnerabilities. I really regret that I can't come up here now with numbers saying that, you know, the average attack space for biometrics when you factor in these cloning techniques is such and such, 2 to the something. I wish I had a good, sensible way of doing that. If anybody has an idea, talk to me offline. I'd love to hear it. But all we can really say is, yes, there are techniques. Networked biometrics require trusted readers, and that poses extra administrative headaches. Yes, you can use biometrics in a network. There are arguably applications where it makes sense. But it's not simply a replacement for passwords. And we can build physical clones of biometric features that spoof biometric readers, evidence. And we can even build clones without the legitimate user's intentional participation. And that's it. And do we have any questions? Oh, come on. Yes. So what you're saying is that some people working in Canada developed a technique of separating biometric identification from biometric authentication, so that one could have highly reliable authentication without being able to tie it to identity? Okay. Okay. And it's a nice piece of work. It'd be if you get a chance, could you send me a reference to that? That would be interesting to look at. Anything else? Yes. The $64,000 question. Is biometrics a viable solution given everything we've talked about? Well, when you consider that if it's between passwords and biometrics, I think the answer is, oh, yeah, they both have a role. If it's between, say, biometrics, passwords, and authentication tokens, I don't think it's nearly as clear. Now, tokens have a bunch of their own problems, just like the really good ones use public key, and we all know how wonderful and easy it is to put in a public key infrastructure. So that's a whole bucket of worms that, you know, makes biometrics almost look easy. And then there's, you know, the secret key based authentication systems. Well, they're out there. They've been there a long time. They have their benefits. And basically, if you want to put in your RADIUS infrastructure or you have a RADIUS infrastructure, then those systems can work too. So there's a bunch of trade-offs there. I've always tended to be a token bias person myself. Person in back? Why am I assuming single-factor authentication? I'm not necessarily assuming single-factor authentication because tokens often involve an additional factor or even two additional factors. And I think that is a crucial part of the whole story is if you're doing single factor, you've already made your first mistake. If you're doing multiple factors, then I'd love to do them with biometrics. It's just the readers tend to be really expensive right now. I think the puppies are like $300 or something, although prices are coming down. But then so does the quality of the readers, so it's a trade-off. Was there another question? Yeah. Let's see, so you're asking how is the biometrics community reacting to this? In other words, how is the legal community reacting to biometrics research? I don't know that they're reacting at all, but then my impression is that the legal community is only beginning to react. Well, I tend to look at this in terms of how much confidence do you get out of an authentication process? And it's not clear to me the legal community considers that these days. Now, maybe there are venues in which this has happened, but I honestly don't know that I've heard of court cases where somebody has said, well, okay, we had this evidence that this person was doing this on a computer because he was authenticated this way, and that technique has this much confidence. Maybe this has happened, I'm not sure. Compared, say, passwords versus biometrics or something. It's not clear to me that anybody's actually had those sorts of questions and issues come out in a legal environment. If somebody knows, I would love to hear it. Anything else? Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Can you speak a little louder, please? Oh, I'm sorry. I still can't hear you. I'm sorry. Okay. Are we done? What? Oh, we were done 5 minutes ago. Thank you, everyone.